Welcome to episode 19 of The Whistleblowers. I'm Luke Decock, with me, John Clockerty. We had a very good, although very hard to hear, time with Brian Kersey in our last episode. I really enjoyed it. I hope everyone was able to hear it enough where they could enjoy it.
You know, Brian will, if we ask, Brian will come back and we'll have another session with him. He, you know, if we tell him that it wasn't up to our standard, he'll come back and we'll do another session. Let's give him some time to get into conference play, and maybe he'll have some stories or issues that he could share with us. So we'll see.
Okay. It was entertaining. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, he's once he got going with the alliance and how they set it up and who's working the games and how they tried to coordinate games with travel. I think he's really high on that, and I think it's a good idea, and I think he was glad to share it with us.
Yeah, there was a couple games last week where I think it was Elon had some ACC guys working a game, and both North Carolina and NC State played at home the next night, and you could kind of see it at work, of those guys getting sent down here, working the game at Elon, and then being in position to work in the same area code the next night.
Well, I think I could share this with you. Early on, my son Tim, who you know well, Luke, he planned a Christmas present to his family, and then he worked with John Cal and Brian Kersey. And what he did, because he could do it, and Brian Kersey and John Cal were receptive, Tim worked a game. This is right after Christmas. He worked a game at Virginia Tech, took his family to Virginia Tech, drove to Pittsburgh, worked a game at Pitt on a Saturday. Then he went to the Steeler game with Cincinnati and then stayed and Monday worked at Duquesne. So he worked one Atlantic 10 game and two ACC games and went to a Steeler game in between and took his entire family. And they had the best time ever. It was a great Christmas gift. He surprised them. They didn't know that it was going to, they didn't know what he was going to do. But he stayed with our relatives, Dorothy's brother and sister. So it was a special time.
Saw Tim the other night for Duke Clemson.
Yeah. Tell me how you thought that went. I mean, I read your article this morning. It was a physical game. You know, I watched it, and it looked like, to me, it was physical. I think we talked about it through text messages, but I think that's going to be kind of standard. I don't think there's going to be any easy games. They're all going to be pretty hard, and they're all going to be somewhat physical.
Yeah, I thought the first 10 minutes I thought were really physical, and I thought it loosened up a little bit after that once Clemson kind of got off the gas a little bit. It was funny. I thought the first 10 minutes were extremely physical and probably very difficult to officiate. And then I asked Brad Brownell after the game about his team's physicality, and he cut me off and said, non-existent.
Yeah.
And I understand he was very unhappy with his team's performance. And I thought the last 20 to 30 minutes, certainly Clemson wasn't as physical. But I thought the first 10 minutes actually kind of threw Duke for a loop a little bit, that ACC physicality and that kind of, the physical play you're going to get in a league play. I think there was an adjustment period there for Duke, and Clemson, to its credit, you know, forced that.
Roger Ayers was worked the game, and I think this is pretty accurate. Coach Krzyzewski thought that maybe Zion Williams was getting handled pretty physical, from what I hear and what I Roger pretty says, he's awful tough to referee, coach, because he looks for contact. He can drive into you, and he's got a big body and he's real strong, and he can withstand that. In the plays I saw, Luke, he probably was getting bumped, but he can finish a play. And I thought, you know, Roger's just saying, coach, you could be right, but maybe he's creating some of that contact.
Yeah, and Kay mentioned that after the game, that he thought that Zion wasn't getting some of the calls he should be getting. If I'm remembering correctly, he said people are so focused on his body, they're missing his hands. You know, officials that you get so caught up in the body contact, you're missing the contact at the hands. At one point, Zion drove into the chest of Elijah Thomas. It was 530 pounds of collision. Those are two big guys.
Could you imagine, taking a charge, when he stole the ball and did the 360 turnaround dunk? If you attempted to cut him off and get there before he started that, that might be a career ender. It can really hurt you.
He's an amazing physical specimen. And I was curious about him coming in because, the film I'd seen and the reputation was that he, in high school, was primarily a dunker. And how would he fit in a Duke team that had two guys who kind of play the same position already, the other two freshmen, R.J. Barrett and Cam Reddish, and could he shoot well enough to be a factor? But he's such a different, unique, you just don't see that kind of physicality and that kind of agility in a body that big. I get how some people are reacting negatively to all the hype from ESPN and whatever, and I get that. I felt the same way about Ben Simmons, who played for a terrible team as opposed to a good Duke team, but.
Luke, you've seen him up close a number of times. I haven't been over there to see a game, or I didn't go to practice to see it, but I've watched Duke maybe two or three times, and he does some other things that I know he'll play hard on defense. He shares the ball. He's not all about, taking, and he seems like he's a good passer. It's kind of shallow, but people will try to look and find what are his weaknesses. And I heard somebody say, well, he's not a catch and shoot guy. Well, so what?
Yeah.
He can catch it and put it on the floor and create a shot like he did the other night. He's got spin moves and he can get in the lane. He can create a shot. He is a different player. That's for sure.
Yeah, underrated spin moves on the block and defensively an unbelievable shot blocker because of his vertical.
Yeah.
I think he's got so much experience being in the spotlight from being this sort of YouTube sensation in high school. I've actually really enjoyed talking to him. He was asked the other night about being recruited by Clemson, which really is where everyone thought he was going to go. And he was very open and honest about it in a way that like college freshmen usually aren't.
Yeah,
you may say, that's in the past. I don't want to talk about it. He talked about the decision and all. I mean, it was a very I think both he and R.J. Barrett are really guys who could have made that leap to the NBA. They kind of talk and act like pros already. Really impressed with both those guys. I couldn't help thinking when Williamson and Thomas collided, if Williamson had gone to Clemson at any other school, those two guys would probably be the two best defensive tackles at the university. Yep. Not at Clemson.
I saw his on-court interview after the game, and he's not bashful in front of the camera, and he's not afraid to talk. He's not him-haw and everything. He's pretty open, and she asked him good questions, and he responded. So it's not the first time he's been interviewed. You can tell that.
He's good at it. Yeah. Anyone in your career as an official who, because of their physicality or their a unique physical specimen like Zion is, who was difficult to officiate?
Yeah, the hardest guy in my 11-year tenure for our officials, that is, was Tyler Hansburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyler Hansburgh, Luke, your research people would have to go back and look. But at one point in time, because Tyler was there for 4 years, I thought that he probably shot more free throws than any player in the history of the ACC basketball. He was getting to the line more than and Coach Williams thought he was not getting to the line enough.
Yeah.
But Tyler Hansburgh was an extremely physical player and very hard to referee, probably the hardest guy. So I asked Steve Robison, I was over watching practice, Carolina and their assistant, Steve Robinson, I talked about Tyler Hansbrough and how difficult, and he was very candid, and he said, John, the reason Tyler is so hard to referee, he says, because he's not going to elevate over you. He's interested in going through you.
Yeah.
And then, of course, if that happens, the defense is not just going to allow him. So they're going to challenge that. And our referees always had a long, hard night when Tyler was playing. He was a tough guy to referee. He doesn't have the same same makeup as this kid Zion. But you ask, was there another guy? Yeah. He was one of those guys that was really hard to referee.
What about when you were on? Oh, by the way, just for the record, Tyler Hansbrough is the all-time leader in free throw attempts nationally, not just in the ACC.
See, you
both
know,
for
and
his
I never
career
saw that.
And his single season.
Yeah. Yeah. That's boy, you got that in a hurry, but that's really good. And I knew that. And of course, his coach would say that statistic means nothing. He should have gone to the free throw line more. You know.
He had 1,241 field free throw attempts. The number two player, Caleb Green from Oral Roberts, is 97 behind. And the number three player is Alonzo Mourning, and he's 218 behind.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. In 07-08, Hansbrough's junior year, he had 377 attempts. That's almost 10 a game.
Yeah. When I was refereeing, I can remember in the Big East, and it started, Luke, back. Villanova had some kids, but Georgetown had Patrick Ewing. They had Alonzo Mourning, a kid named Graham, who was always looking to mix things up. And on the other end, you had Derek Coleman, in my opinion, was as tough a kid as any Georgetown player or any Villanova player, any St. John's player you wanted. This is one person's opinion.
Yeah.
Derek Coleman was a man. But it seemed like there was an edge on every one of those Big East games where you just were waiting for things to explode. And a lot of times they did. But that was the most physical period of time officiated.
And the whole six fouls thing.
In the whole six fouls. You know, they thought they wanted to keep the better players on the floor. They put a six foul experiment in. Guy like Alonzo Mourning, they were never taking him out in the first half when he got two fouls.
Right.
Because he had four more that he can get. So they now, you know, a guy like Alonzo Mourning gets two fouls. I'm just using him for an example. You might take him out and put him on the bench, but not with six fouls.
Derek Coleman, by the way, 2015 ACC legend. Because when I think of ACC basketball, I think of Derek Coleman.
No.
Ronnie Cicely, future ACC legend. Derek Coleman, current ACC legend.
Of course, he never played in the ACC.
Hey, that's just the way it is. That's expansion.
Yeah.
Speaking of ACC legends, let's talk about Carl Hess.
Okay.
We made you wait 15 minutes for it, but we got to Carl. So, obviously, no stranger to this podcast in terms of a topic of discussion. Carl was back in the news this week. Thursday, the East Tennessee State Samford game stalked across the floor into Samford's huddle to get in the face of Scott Padgett, who's no shrinking violet himself. Padgett, after the game, said he asked Hess if he was stepping to him and said, nobody does that on the street. I'm whatever, 6'9", 260. And then Saturday at Wofford, there's no video, but apparently in the Wofford-Mercer game, there was an incident with Mercer as well. Hard to say what the degree of that was, but the video on Padgett, the Padgett confrontation was certainly very striking. And him storming into a huddle, that was something I believe you had to deal with at least once when he was in the ACC.
Luke, you know, I would have thought that after what happened in the ACC, and we had no choice but at that point in time, I guess we had a choice, but we found it was in the best interest to cut our ties with Carl. That was just one incident where we had to let him go. But even prior to that, you know, Carl at Georgia Tech, Brian Gregory was a coach at Georgia Tech, and Brian Gregory called timeout, I guess, much like Pageant. And before he went into his huddle, I'm talking about Brian Gregory, he said something to Carl about whether there should have been a foul or something about the referee. Now Brian Gregory's addressing his team, and Carl Hess rushes in there and jumps in Brian Gregory's face as he's talking to his team. And it was a bad. I was at Georgia Tech, and of course all the players turned their head. It was a distraction. Now they're looking at Carl Hess, and Brian Gregory has lost their attention, and he's getting scolded in front of his players. And you can imagine the phone call I get the next morning. So Brian Gregory's calling me, and I simply talked to Hess, and I told him, Brian, there's another way to do that. You wait till the timeout is over. Go and speak to Coach Gregory. Tell him that you've had enough or whatever. But I says, but you can't go in a coach's huddle. That's a off the limits area. You can't, no official, whether it's you or anybody else, can go in a coach's huddle. Get him after, there's going to be a first horn. He's got to send his team out. Just go to him then. But apparently, what I told him, it went in one ear and not the other, because that was a very similar situation, except this guy that he's trying to get and mix it up with is 6'9" or 6'8". But talking about Carl Hess, you know, that was one incident. There was a couple more that I won't get into. That wasn't the first one. The last one that we had to deal with was him saying something that was construed as being racist up at Wake Forest. We sat on it for a couple days, myself and Commissioner Swofford and Paul Brazzo. We sat on it, and we had more than one or two meetings, and we finally thought that it was time to let Carl go. And then when we let him go, I think the Big East dropped him. I'm not sure. I don't keep track of Carl Hess. I don't know where he works, but. And then I think, you know, I think he's dealt recently with some health problems. I don't know to what extent, but he had some heart problems. Mm-hmm. And I think I talked to Brian Kersey about it. I think Brian stays in touch with him. But, you know, I just don't know.
Okay. I mean, you know, and I want to clarify something I said earlier in the Wofford game. It wasn't altercation, not altercation. It was a controversial play, a foul on Mercer that was ruled a travel, and Mike Young, the Wofford coach, got teed up by Carl in that scenario. And now Mike Young, so after the game, there was a report out of Spartanburg that Hess, after the two confrontations, perhaps because he was being threatened with discipline by the Southern Conference, was threatening to retire. Mike Young responded to that by saying on Twitter that he hoped it wasn't true, that he likes Carl and thinks he's a good official. And I think that's always been what's so difficult about Carl, is the altercations or the incidents, whether it was throwing out Corciani and Gugliotta from behind the state scorers table, or, you know, not working all those state games and coming back and then teeing up Mark Gottfried at the first TV timeout. The incident you mentioned with Mitch Shaw at Wake Forest, you know, the biggest booster Wake Forest basketball has, getting in that on the sideline. And then, you know, the collateral damage, the 2012 ACC tournament, where Hess was had been suspended for the Corciani-Gugliotta incident, and then for you would know better than I would, either was invited not to participate in the ACC tournament or decided not to participate in the ACC tournament in Atlanta. And then the officials for the first game of the tournament came out with KH stickers on their shoes. And that became a whole sideshow. And those guys were reprimanded but continued to work the tournament because, frankly, you guys didn't have enough bodies without them and Carl, who had been scheduled to work the tournament. It just, you know, Mike Young raises a good point. He's a good official. You always cut him a lot of slack, or tried to cut him as much slack, at least from where I sit, when he was in the ACC, because you felt like he could call a good game. But there's a certain point, it seems like, where that'll end up catching up with you.
Yeah. You know, everything you just said, all the incidents you brought up, the Corcioni, you brought up another situation. And look, there was other situations other than the ones that you haven't even mentioned. I get a call from Maryland, and he's rushing to a game. He's late, and the security that's to meet him and take him to the dressing room makes some smart-aleck remark. I'm talking about the security guy, and Hess calls him nothing but a rent-a-cop. And it's insulting to that person, and that person tells the game day manager that he's been called a rent-a-cop by Carl Hess. Now, as a supervisor, I'm getting all this, but everything you said has created a chaotic situation surrounding Carl Hess for years. And so when the last straw was the thing at Wake Forest, and that's when we decided that we would have to, and I'm hearing this secondhand, and it's certainly, it comes to me that that the Southern Conference may have given him a in-house reprimand for his actions with Mercer. What was it? Mercer, East Tennessee?
Well, it was East Tennessee, Samford, and Wofford, yeah. Mercer.
No, I don't know. I don't know that for a fact, because it was never in the paper. But that's just one official telling another official.
So is that mean he's done working there, or he would continue to work?
No,
there?
I think it remains to be seen.
Okay.
I don't know.
You know, it's kind of a sad fall for a guy who's worked multiple Final Fours. He worked 4 SoCon games, non-conference games in November, 3 in December, and 2 in January. I mean, for a guy like that to get to January 7th and have only 9 Division I games on his schedule, at least as far as I can tell, that's not a lot of work.
It's not a lot of work, and it tells me, unless Carl has made that his decision, that the American's not using him, the SEC's not using him, the Big East is not using him, Pac-12 is not, he's working the Southern Conference.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know whether this is the last time we'll talk about Carl Hess or not, but certainly wasn't the first time.
Yeah. I know that our referees, when I was with the ACC, for the most part, liked working with him. They thought he was a strong referee, and our coaches, for the most part, recognized that he was a strong referee. This is another thing is that I haven't ever brought up, but some people get what I would refer to as the Final Four syndrome. They've gotten to the Final Four, they've worked the Final Four, and they get inflated egos, and that works against them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Let's move on to a couple listener questions, if you will. Howard Pollock wrote to ask, we talked about last year the point of emphasis regarding screens set more than shoulder width apart. He asks, he hasn't seen that called this year.
Well, there's been no change in the rule. And the rule book still says when setting screens, you have to set it within the shoulder width. You can't start spreading eagle and getting way out there. If you've seen it, I'm talking about the person that asked the question, if they have seen it and it's not being called, then those officials are ignoring it and thinking it's, Now, a person can set a screen. Look, so we understand something. That person can set a screen and have it wide like that, but if there's no contact, then there's no foul.
Okay.
Okay. That, unless that screener has been put at a disadvantage by making contact, then there's no then he can stand out there and do whatever he wants if there's no contact.
Okay. The other question, and this was multiple people, not Howard asked this question and a couple others, in various different ways of asking the question. Does the new freedom that ball handlers have to carry the ball Euro steps, one, is that ever going to get called? Is carrying just a part of the game now? And two, does that make it harder for defenders to play defense without using their hands because the ball handler can do so much with the ball that at one point, and we may be going back to the Jurassic era, but at one point, ball handlers didn't have that freedom. How has that changed from an officiating perspective?
Look, I don't... First of all, it's a problem, and it's been a topic of discussion not only with the general fan population, but with supervisors and about palming the ball and handling it and carrying it. And there's been a point of emphasis about crossover dribbles. And
What's the point of emphasis on crossover dribbles?
The point, you're not supposed to have your hand underneath the ball. You can allow the hand to be on the side of the ball. Okay. But you can't, even if it was on the side of the ball, you can't bring it back and have a hesitation dribble. If you can, you can't bring it back and hold it, then bring it back down, whether it's under the ball, side of the ball, whatever.
Okay.
We are never going to go back to, I like that, you say a Jurassic era, whatever you said, but you can't, you're not going to have your hand on top of the ball. Okay. But what's happened is, our officials look at that play, and it's, and I'm not saying they're right, and I say our officials, but officials look at that play, and they'll say, is he putting the defense at a disadvantage? And if he is, with crossover dribbles, with palming the ball, with hesitation dribbles, then you have to call that. You have to call that carrying.
We never see that called, though.
Well, you know, you can't go back to Allen Iverson and what he was doing and put it in the college game, and because and then it just gets so bad. Look, I'm telling you, the guys I play golf with and they'll say to me, is anybody ever going to call carrying the ball again? And so it, you know, it's very noticeable. But kids, if you go to AAU. A middle school game or a junior high school game, that's where it starts.
Sure.
These kids are carrying the ball, that thing. And they got small hands and they turn it over. I hope I'm making some sense, but if they're coming up the floor and nobody's guarding them, a referee is not going to pretty much care what he does with the ball. Once he gets some defensive pressure in front of him, if he starts these hesitation dribbles and crossovers behind their back and this and that, you're going to interrupt the game, but it is, Luke, I'm the first guy that you don't want to interrupt the game, but it's gone way too, you're going to have to figure out how to get this back, because I agree with the person that asked the questions. They're allowing so much palming and crossovers and spin moves. Guys will spin move, will grab the ball, turn it around their back, and that's a carry. But I'm telling you how I feel. It's going to take something major to get this back to normalcy, but because it has just kept going and going and going, and high school kids do it, and even starting junior high, they're carrying the ball. But you're not going to get anybody. If you look at the rule book, they talk about, I don't know the mechanics, but nobody's going to dribble the ball with their hand on top of the ball, Luke.
Yeah. I mean, here's my question. A, is the genie out of the bottle? Like, we have to have this massive crackdown on carrying that's going to lead to 58 turnovers in every game to change it. Because I don't think anyone wants that.
How do you good dribble then?
And B, should the rule just be rewritten?
Now, you know, that probably is a better solution, because you and I are never going to see them going back to dribbling the ball with the hand on top of the ball. I mean, Dick Groat's not playing anymore. Okay. And so evolution went from top of the ball to side of the ball to underneath the ball. You're not going to get it back on top of the ball. Maybe rewriting the rule, but you can't allow some of them, I see some of them called when they make a clear turnover, face up the defense and turn
over. That's when you see it called. See it called in a one-on-one guarded situation, typically on the perimeter, where the guy faces up to the defender and takes the ball and flips it over in his hand.
You
you see that called, but you don't see it called in transition. You don't see it called in the post. It seems like there's acceptable areas to call carrying or palming or whatever, and unacceptable, and areas where it's just not going to get called.
Yeah. So. And if we were sitting here with a couple supervisors or a couple experienced referee, they'll say, we would get the ones and where they really put the defense at a disadvantage with a palming or hesitation dribble. We need to get those. That's what their answer to. We want to get those. We don't want to call the marginal ones and interrupt the game. You would be interrupting the game all night long.
Okay. One other listener question. This one comes from Brett Strelo, who, when he was at the Fayetteville Observer, was the king of writing about basketballs. What teams used them? Did it in the ACC? Did it in the when he was covering Appalachian State? Now in the Sports Info department there. His question for you was, do you have any stories from your career about equipment issues? The wrong ball, broken backboards, collapsed stanchions, uniform issues? I'll leave out Precision Time because I know there were some hiccups with that in the early days.
I'll give you one where we were in the Colonial Tournament, which I assigned, and they're playing for about 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes. And one of the players says, ref, this ball is not a legal ball. He said, what do you mean it's not a legal ball? He says, this ball is too small. And they have been playing with the women's ball.
How long have they been playing with the women's
ball? 6 or 7 minutes.
Before anyone noticed?
Yeah, before one of the players noticed it. They said, this ball is too small.
Did they warm up with like a
rack
of women's balls?
I don't know that. I called a guy named Ray Perrone who was in the game. I said, Ray, tell me you didn't play 6 or 7 minutes or whatever it was with a women's ball. He said, it's on me, John. He said, I was the referee. He said, the ball felt like it was illegal. He said, we played with it, and that was it, okay? So I says, well, you know.
This is a tournament game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a tournament game. So anyway, we did that, and then.
How does that get screwed up?
I said, Luke, I don't know how the women's ball got on the rack of basketballs, okay? But you would think as soon as you picked it up and shot with it and warm-ups or something, you would notice. But
well, it's possible no one wanted to say anything because they like shooting with it better.
I feel like that's right.
Well, everyone was just hoping no one would notice.
When I was refereeing, I can remember this because they showed on the highlights all the time. Jerome Lane.
Oh, was that your game?
Yeah.
Jerome?
Send it home, Jerome. I was in that game. It was against Providence, and Billy Raffery was doing the game. I was with Gene Mongi, and I'm not sure the third guy, but when I tell you, Jerome thunder dunked that ball, and if you go back and look, there is no hanging on the rim. You know, like some of these big guys can hang on the ring and next
pull
thing
it
you
down,
know,
yeah.
pull it down. Jerome just bang, and then that backboard exploded. So, you know, I can remember that.
That may be more famous than the Seton Hall foul.
Please. We're talking about equipment here.
But that is, I mean, there's an entire postseason prediction tournament based on the send it in Jerome.
Yeah, send it in Jerome.
I mean, that is one of the most famous calls in modern college basketball history, plays.
It's good. And you talk about You know, if Michigan gets to the Final Four this year, mark my word, how often they're going to play the Michigan Seton Hall. If Michigan gets to the Final Four,
did they last year?
Yeah, they did last year. Absolutely, they preempted it a lot. So I just can't get away from that call, Luke.
It's going to chase you around. Well, I would tell more people a story about Jerome Lane.
Yeah, Jerome Lane. Yeah. And then the other thing is, I have a game between Texas and Providence, and Rick Barnes is at Texas. And Timmy Welsh is the coach of Providence, and it comes down to the last shot. And the LED lights are supposed to be synced with the clock.
Right.
They're supposed to be standard. And now one goes off, and the time is still there. The LED lights go off, and the clock has not run out.
It has like 0.01 or something.
Yeah. Okay. And they score. And Providence thinks they win. Texas is contesting it. We had to go to the monitor, and it was clear that they weren't synced. And the next thing you know, we come out, no basket. Providence loses. Texas wins because we went to the shot. We went to the game clock rather than the LED lights, and it. And we had a hell of a time getting out of the Dunkin' Donut Arena or whatever they call it up there. But those three things, I could probably list a lot of things. I think these precision timers that these officials are using, they don't like it. They go to the monitor to see if before the game, you've been to they'll blow the whistle to see if it's synced.
Yeah, let me jump in here and just explain what precision time is. Okay. This is the system. It started in the ACC.
Yes.
Where the referees wear little belt packs where they can start the clock, and then they wear microphones on their lanyards and their whistles automatically stop the clock, and the whole thing is synced to the clock, and they started using it in the NCAA tournament now. So the official timer there's no leeway with waiting for the official timer to stop the clock. The clock starts when the referees want it to start, and it stops when they blow their whistle. That's precision time. In the early days, the technology was a little hairier than it is now, if I remember correctly. Yeah. But now it seems like it works reasonably well most of the time.
It'll work well until, if it works well, when you blow the whistle, it stops the game clock. Okay. And you'll see them before the game, they'll all test their whistles to see if it's in sync. In my tenure as the supervisor, our officials would go and always put 3/10 of a second, 4/10 of a second. And I'm thinking, why are you going to the monitor to see if we have the correct? If you blew the whistle and it stopped the clock, why are we going to the monitor? So Mike Eads tells me, John, I'm telling you, I'm blowing my whistle and there's still 3/10 of a second that comes off. 3/10 of a second added to whatever else is, you know, my officials don't. It's better than not having it.
Okay.
It's better than not having it, but I don't think it's 100% foolproof. But there's not getting any rid of it. The NBA is using it now, but
yeah, I think it's a lot better than the alternative.
It's all better than the alternative. But
John, I got a lot of problems with officials. Precision time isn't one of them.
Well, everybody
going to the monitor. For stupid stuff that I have a problem with. Precision time, I'm willing to call that even and move on.
You know, since they've expanded the use of monitor, look, I tell you, I watch these playoff football games. I don't think they can have one or two series before somebody's going looking at the monitor.
I hate instant replay. I know you feel differently. No, I know officials feel differently about it because they want to get it right. But I just feel like, with the exception of maybe a few certain circumstances like the end of a game, I think we go to the monitor way too much in every sport, not just college basketball, the NFL especially. I'd like to see replay cut down to the point where there's very little of it. It's in game-ending situations only or one coach's challenge or something. we're taking 5 minutes to determine a hook and hold. And I get that that's this year and it's, now, a, and know, it's all that. But some of the flagrant reviews take forever and go nowhere.
Yeah.
I get it, but I would just like to reduce the number of times we go to the monitor. And college football is even worse.
Yeah. Oh, college football is almost unwatchable. They have so many interruptions. But look, can I just – I'll tell you how one use of the monitor – I was not a big proponent of expanding the monitor, but – I don't know what year it was, but I have a regional final between Michigan State and Georgia Tech, and it's in New Orleans, and Kenny Anderson comes down in regulation, and in transition and hurries up Kenny Anderson, and shoots what I think is a three, and it goes in, and I signal three, and Georgia Tech thinks they have won the game and are headed to the locker room. And an official that I'm working with comes over and says, John, we need to review this because I think his front part of his foot was on the line. I says, are you sure? He said, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure. We go to the monitor, and his foot's on the line, which ends up being a two. The game goes overtime. But Bob, I have to tell Bobby Cremins that his team's got to come back out and play. And
Judd, how'd Bobby take that?
Bobby was the best. That's why I consider him, okay. Judd Heathcote came down and said, what do we got? And I said, Judd, no, I said, we're going to review this. And Judd Heathcote doesn't know because he's up there and this shot's down at the other end. He doesn't know, Luke. So he comes down. I said, Coach, let us get it straight. And, you know, I'm the guy that called the thing good. And Bobby Cremins says, John, you told us we have a three. And he wants, but he's so good. He came back in, and they beat Michigan State pretty handedly because they had the better team. But if we don't have a review, we're deciding a team that goes to the final.
I don't have a problem with it in that case. I think it's become too much of a crutch sometimes. Especially in college football.
They're leaning on it. They are definitely leaning on it.
And I get the, you know, there's so much money involved and all that. People want to get it right. And if it takes a little while, that's fine. But to me, there's also a certain attitude where officials are human. They're going to do the best they can. Let's live with some of it and get the really important stuff right on the monitor. Not some of the left. That's just me. I know not everyone agrees with me. I'm kind of anti-replay, but I would like to see it used a little bit less. Mm-hmm. That's just me. Mm-hmm. Anything else, John?
Well, we're back into you have three seasons. You have post-conference, exhibition season, post-conference. Then you have conference season, which I saw Coach Krzyzewski a little bit and says, we can tell we're in conference play. We are definitely in conference play. Every game's going to be not every game, but I was surprised that Florida State wasn't more competitive against Virginia. I thought that would really be a good game. But then we'll figure out in a couple months, and then we'll get into end of season, postseason tournament, and then NCAA. But the level of play went up in the last week for sure.
Yeah, it was noticeable, and hopefully we'll have more. As always, thank you for listening. Happy New Year. If you have plays, you have questions, you have issues you want us to discuss or talk about, we're happy to do that. You can reach out to me on Twitter at Luke DeCock or via email ldecock@newsobserver.com. Happy to look at those for you, get John's expertise or confuse him, as the case may be.
Well, you know, we're going to have I'm lining up a couple guests. Hopefully for the next time we're on, we're going to have a guest. And again, you know, I think we'll get some people that are involved in ACC basketball or just basketball in general and add them to the show.
Yeah, I think it's better when it's not just you and me talking. Of course, we've only had one podcast that wasn't just you and me talking.
That's right.
So.
All right.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back soon. Hopefully, we'll be on a little more regular schedule now that we're in the thick of basketball season. But thanks again for listening. Happy New Year, and we will talk to you soon.